Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Scott Klinger with the Institute for Policy Studies, who summarizes the findings of his group's new report titled Executive Excess 2011, the Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging. Sarah Van Gelder, executive editor at Yes Magazine, who talks about how new communities are forming in the United States to create cooperative models for sustainable employment in the nation's weak economy. And Laura Moy of Amnesty International USA, who talks about the international campaign to stop the execution of Troy Davis in Georgia, scheduled for September 21st. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Incoming United States Ambassador to Egypt, Ann Patterson, got a rude awakening when she was installed in early August and was greeted with this headline in a state-run magazine, "The Ambassador from Hell Lights a Fire in Tahrir." According to the Christian Science Monitor, Egypt's political establishment took issue with the Obama administration's plan to bypass the government and give $65 million in funding directly to independent pro-democracy groups. Officials from the U.S. Agency for International Development, AID, held a series of workshops in Egyptian cities instructing non-governmental groups on how to access the grant money. The agency's goals were to further civic engagement, improve access to justice, and promote the establishment of political parties. Meanwhile, the U.S. government provides over $1.3 billion a year in direct aid to Egypt's military, which now controls the government. Egypt's Minister of International Cooperation, a holdover from the Mubarak era, announced he would investigate all civil society AID recipients. The minister further accused civil society groups of harming the nation by taking American pro-democracy funds. Egypt's pro-democracy leaders also shunned the AID funding, stating, "We do not need American help. We overthrew Mubarak on our own, and we will build a new Egypt with our own hands as well." Ultimately, the vast majority of U.S. pro-democracy funds went to American-based groups such as the National Democratic and National Republican Institutes to help promote the establishment of political parties in November's upcoming parliamentary election. Within Haiti's sprawling resettlement camps, a newborn infant might not see a doctor for weeks, and young children suffer from preventable diseases like diarrhea. Olivier Gayroy, a health worker for Save the Children, told the Miami Herald, "These camps are not an appropriate place for a delivery or a newborn." Even before the January 2010 earthquake that devastated Haiti, the Caribbean nation had the highest maternal death rate in the Western Hemisphere. The post-earthquake health status of women and girls is unknown since the Haitian government stopped collecting data on infant and maternal mortality. Over 300,000 Haitian women and girls currently live in resettlement camps. They experience high rates of hunger, disease, and fear of gender-based violence. Human Rights Watch notes some women have engaged in unprotected sex in exchange for food, but others have banded together to protect themselves against violence. Meanwhile, human rights researchers discovered that only half of the $260 million allocated for post-earthquake health care has actually been spent. The new Republican majority in the House of Representatives has teamed up with lobbyists from big banks and insurance companies to stall key consumer reforms in the Dodd-Frank Financial Service Reform Law. According to the Center for Public Integrity, key provisions at risk are the requirement for stockbrokers and insurance agents to act as fiduciaries for small investors, the creation of an Office of Investor Advocate in the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, and funding for the new Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. In recent months, most of the freshman Republicans on the House Financial Services Committee received over 40% of all their political action committee funds from finance, real estate, and insurance interests. Consumer groups have complained about the committee's stalling tactics, but their protests were largely ignored. This spring, New Jersey GOP Representative Scott Garrett, chair of the Subcommittee on Capital Markets, attacked the rule on requiring brokers to put client interests before their own profits. To block the rule, Garrett called for a cost-benefit analysis on the measure, and the SEC responded by eliminating the provision. The Senior Citizens Lobby Group, AARP, is one of the strongest supporters of making brokers meet the fiduciary standard and plans to do its own research regarding the financial impact of the fiduciary rule. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In response to continuing high unemployment and an anemic economy that threatens to turn into a double-dip recession, President Obama addressed a joint session of Congress and the nation on September 8th to propose a $447 billion package of tax cuts and new federal outlays designed to boost consumer spending and create jobs. Prospects for passage of Mr. Obama's jobs legislation appear dim as congressional Republicans oppose the president's plan to fund the jobs bill by raising taxes on the rich. Specifically, the White House wants to impose new limits on itemized deductions for individuals who earn more than $200,000 a year and families earning more than $250,000, which they expect to generate $467 billion needed to fund the new jobs bill. The declining rate of taxation on America's wealthiest citizens and profitable corporations is one major reason for decreasing revenues to fund federal programs. A new report by the Institute for Policy Studies titled Executive Excess 2011, The Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging, highlights stark problems of fairness in the U.S. economy. The group's 18th annual investigation of CEO compensation found that of last year's 100 highest-paid corporate executives in the United States, 25 took home more in pay than their company paid in 2010 federal income taxes. And of the 25 companies that paid their CEO more than they paid in taxes, 20 also spent more on lobbying congressional legislators than they paid to the IRS. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Scott Klinger, an IPS Associate Fellow and co-author of the Executive Excess Report, who summarizes the findings of the investigation and the urgent problem of growing income inequality in America.
We first noticed this trend last year in 2009. There was one of the highest paid CEOs that made more than his company, Occidental Petroleum, paid in income taxes. And we thought that was horrendous. We couldn't believe it. You know, here, all the things of value that a corporation gets from the government, from an educated workforce to infrastructure to regulatory programs that assure their products and services are safe, even things like patent protection and courts to protect intellectual property. All those things of value, companies feel quite comfortable telling the government that's worth less than the services of one man or woman who leads our company. And so we began to look at that as a theme coming into this year, and the proxy reports tend to come in right after the first of the year in the spring. And we began to see that more and more companies were paying their CEOs more than they paid in federal corporate income taxes. And by mid-year, when pretty much most of the results were in, we looked at the top 100 highest paid CEOs in the United States and found that 25 of them received more in compensation in 2010 than their companies paid in federal corporate income taxes. We think that's a shameful number. And most of these companies, virtually all of them, were quite profitable. On average, they had $1.9 billion in profits. So these aren't companies that were, you know, struggling and didn't have any income to pay taxes on. It was that they were very profitable but found ways to avoid their taxes. The other thing we looked at was sort of how does this happen? And one of the things we thought about is that companies are really writing the tax codes or telling Congress what to write in the tax codes. And we found that 20 of the 25 companies spent more on lobbying Congress than they paid in federal corporate income taxes, and 18 of them had higher investments in corporate political campaigns than they paid in federal corporate income taxes. Lastly, one of the numbers that we track every year is the ratio of average CEO pay to average worker pay. And last year, it skyrocketed. It was up to 325-1. Which was up from 263-1 in 2009. So that was one of the largest jumps we've seen. It's still not back to the record levels before the recession in 2007, but it's getting awfully close.
Scott, another issue that this country has seen unfold over recent decades is growing income inequality in the United States, where we have the gulf between the rich and the poor widening to the greatest point of any industrialized nation in the world right now. And I wonder how you feel your investigations into tax rates of big corporations and the gulf between worker and CEO pay relates to growing income inequality.
Well, it's certainly at the crux of the economic problems that we all face right now, including the problems faced by business, because the problem that businesses are facing aren't that their taxes are too high, it's that they have no demand for their products. And the reason they don't have any demand for their products is because the middle class is getting poorer and poor people are getting poorer, and people don't have money to spend at businesses to buy things, to create more jobs with their demand. I talked to a business person today, a small business owner, and he said, you know, if he had 100 people in his neighborhood by his business, he'd much rather have all of them making an average of $80,000 instead of having three make $10 million and the rest make $10,000. You know, that's the sort of scenario we have, you know, and he kind of followed that up and said the rich can only buy so many toasters. So the fact that we have all the pooling of money in very few hands is not a system that serves anyone, including business.
Scott, just a final question before we say goodnight, and that is, in this election year coming up, one of the big debates is going to be over tax policy, whether rates on wealthy corporations and individuals should be raised even to the levels they were back during the Clinton administration. The Republicans and their corporate allies seem determined to freeze things in place, not to move in increasing them in any direction. And I wonder, where do you think public opinion stands on the idea of taxing the rich at higher rates here as the country faces this deficit crisis that a lot of these same Republican and conservative politicians are screaming about on a daily basis?
Well, I think the tide is really turning, and I think the polls I've seen suggest that more and more people believe that the rich should pay more, and taxing the rich is an appropriate way to preserve Social Security and preserve the kind of community investments and jobs for teachers and policemen and firefighters that we all have come to count on and support. And I think there's incredible outrage when companies that are making billions of dollars in profits end up not paying any taxes at all. So we're not in favor of raising the rates on corporations, but we are in favor of dramatically closing the loopholes and making sure that all companies pay a fair share and that large corporations end up paying more like what they used to pay in terms of supporting the services the federal government provides.
That was Scott Klinger, associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of the group's new report titled Executive Excess 2011, The Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging. Find a link to the report and more on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The official jobless rate in the U.S. hovers around 9%, with the real unemployment rate estimated to be as much as 16%. Those grim statistics translate to some 25 million Americans unemployed, underemployed, or having given up looking for work. Unemployment is by far the most important issue for a large majority of Americans, but with the election of the GOP-controlled House of Representatives last November, the imposition of austerity measures to reduce the nation's deficit has until recently been the number one preoccupation in Washington. And while many of the nation's largest corporations are reporting record profits, the U.S. poverty rate increased to the highest level seen in two decades. A recent Census Bureau report found that median income fell 2.3% from 2009 to 2010, while the number of Americans without health insurance increased to nearly 50 million. In the midst of this dismal economic environment, a new do-it-ourselves movement is emerging across the country, where communities are forming to create innovative and cooperative models for sustainable employment and alternative financing of small business enterprises. In a series of articles titled New Livelihoods, How We're Building the Do-It-Ourselves Economy, just published in Yes Magazine, people tell stories about how they created their own jobs with the help of neighbors who shared ideas, space, and local buying power. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and executive editor at Yes Magazine, who talks about this movement that's creating new models for employment and redefining middle-class values.
Going it alone isn't necessarily going to work. And so often I think the message we get is that if you're not doing well in this economy, it's your own fault. You didn't try hard enough for a job, or you weren't talented enough to rise to the top. Well, it's not your own fault. The dynamics that are at work right now are that ordinary Americans have been losing out for decades. We've been seeing our wages stagnate, people made up for it by working lots of extra hours and by having more than one wage earner in a family. Our wages kept stagnating while more and more wealth was accumulating at the top, and so people made up for that by going deeper and deeper into debt. And now with this recession or depression, depending on what you want to call it, those options are no longer there. The jobs aren't there for us to work the extra hours, and we can't go further into debt because of what happened to housing prices and credit. So people are really hurting. And yes, this issue looks at a lot of things that people are doing to make things work for themselves and their communities, and also the kinds of changes that we need to come together around so that we can get the government to once again be working on behalf of ordinary people instead of on behalf of large corporations. I guess the starting point, the best place to start, was at the neighborhood and community level, because that's where the jobs are created. Big corporations have actually reduced employment by about 3 million jobs over the last decade. So the jobs are coming from small business and medium-sized business, and they're coming from local communities. So we ask the question, what does it take to get those local economies functioning again so that people can get jobs? And, you know, there's no sort of silver bullets. There aren't any, you know, magic wands you can wave and suddenly you'll have millions of jobs in your local community or even thousands of jobs. But each community has its strengths, and if we focus on those strengths and we make sure to support our local businesses and buy from them instead of from the Walmarts or from the big box stores, buy from our local businesses, if we look for ways to build on the institutions that are thriving. For example, one of my favorite stories is from Cleveland, Ohio, which is, you know, known as a Rust Belt city, which has had tremendous economic problems. And what they did is they looked for where they have their strengths, and they have their strengths in a university and in a hospital and in a clinic. And they looked for ways, a local foundation and some local community groups, they looked for ways that they could build on those local strengths to create worker-owned cooperatives that could sell to those institutions. And now they have a worker-owned laundry that supplies laundry services to the hospital. They have a worker-owned solar company that rents the roof space on the roof of the university and several other institutions and sells electricity to the university. And they're just building a worker-owned greenhouse that will be growing massive amounts of local greens that can supply those institutions year-round with fresh local produce. So that's one of my favorite stories, because it shows what we can do in our own local communities, even the ones that are really hard hit by an ongoing economic crisis.
Sarah, how effective are approaches to creating your own jobs and sustaining your livelihood even in the midst of this horrible economy with things like job sharing and space sharing and cooperative efforts in general? How is that a healthy and an effective approach?
Well, I think one of the strengths of doing that is that a lot of small businesses or a lot of people who would like to start a small business, there's a lot of barriers, and one of them is the initial costs of getting going. So if you can do something like have an office space that's shared by a lot of different small-scale entrepreneurs, startups, you know, where people need a desk space and they need internet and they need some camaraderie and they need a place to get coffee, but Starbucks just isn't quite enough as a workspace. You know, those kinds of things can help people get that first step up. And even a stronger example, I think, is kitchen incubators. Because if you decide that you have, you know, just the right salsa recipe and you could make salsa and sell it at the farmer's market or sell it to restaurants, well, you have to get your kitchen certified by the health department. And that's a big barrier for a lot of people who are just trying to start up. So a number of communities have started kitchen incubators. It might be a church kitchen that gets certified by the health department. And once it's got that certification and once you've got your food handling license, you can go ahead and try it out and see if you can make that recipe and see if you can make your business work. So those are different ways of lowering the entry barrier so that ordinary people who may not be able to find a 9-to-5 job can go out and start their own small businesses or micro businesses and make ends meet.
Sarah, you talk about in the article the idea that these local movements, these local new models of economic development and economic survival also can contribute to the pressure that's needed from grassroots movements to make sure that government at the federal level is really doing what it's supposed to be doing to really help those in need in terms of the legacy of the Great Depression, where these social safety net programs were developed. And of course, now they're under attack.
That's right. It's not, you know, I think as important as all the local economy building is, we also really do need our federal government to start working on behalf of us, ordinary people, and not in so much on behalf of what Wall Street wants and what big corporations want. And as far as I can see in U.S. history, the way that that happens is because people come together, form social movements of various kinds, and insist on it.
That was Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and executive editor at Yes Magazine. Find a link to read the publication's New Livelihoods, How We're Building the Do-It-Ourselves Economy articles by visiting our website at btlonline.org. Troy Davis is an African-American man who's been sitting on Georgia's death row for 20 years. Though no physical evidence linked him to the 1989 murder of police officer Mark Allen McPhail, 9 witnesses testified that he was the killer. Since then, 7 of these witnesses have recanted their testimony, declaring that they were pressured by law enforcement to wrongly point to Davis. However, Georgia's court system has chosen to believe only what these witnesses stated on the record during the trial of 1991. One of 2 witnesses who has not changed his original testimony is Sylvester Red Coles, one of the early principal suspects. According to defense attorneys, there is new evidence implicating him in the shooting. 9 individuals have signed affidavits implicating Sylvester Coles in the murder. Davis has seen 3 other execution dates come and go. But now, after all his appeals and efforts to be granted a new trial have been exhausted, Troy Davis faces execution on September 21st. Amnesty International is part of a worldwide campaign to convince Georgia's government to stop Davis's execution. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Laura Moy, death penalty abolition campaign director at Amnesty International USA, who talks about Davis's case and the possible outcomes of the global effort on his behalf.
We were starting our campaign in February 2007. He received a July execution date. Since that time, his case has taken a number of twists and turns in the legal system. He's had 3 execution dates and 3 stays of execution, and we've been campaigning very hard from 2007 and bringing in coalition partners such as the NAACP and other organizations to join voices and to really build what has become a very vibrant movement. Now hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people have been signing the petition for clemency. Even our own petition, since the execution warrant was issued this past Tuesday, we've had over 100,000 signatures in 1 week's period alone. It doesn't count the hundreds of thousands that have been accumulated for a longer period of time. So we've been trying to educate people about the problems in Troy Davis's case and the fact that the legal system has completely failed in terms of taking very seriously the issue of whether his conviction is still reliable. The legal process has been very narrowly focused on procedure and technicality. It has not really been an adequate safety net for somebody with an innocence claim. And, you know, he had a special evidentiary hearing last year in Savannah in a federal court. And this is a case that does not have physical evidence. His lawyers presented witness testimony. But at the end of the day, the judge has to either say he believes the witnesses now or he doesn't. And so the very witnesses who Troy Davis's death sentences relies on are the very same witnesses that the courts won't believe today. And almost none of them have stood by their trial testimony. So it's very disturbing to us. Troy Davis had the burden of proving his innocence. Once he was convicted, there is no longer this reasonable doubt standard. And we think that no execution should be going forward when there's any doubt as to a person's guilt. There can't be any alternative explanation of the facts when you're talking about the irreversible sentence of death. And, of course, this is why we oppose the death penalty, is that we think it's just too much power. The risks are too high when we allow the state to carry out this unnecessary and brutal punishment.
Laura Moy, what does Amnesty International want for Troy Davis? Clemency? A new trial?
Well, you know, Troy Davis has tried to seek a new trial, and he did not succeed in winning a new trial. And now at this juncture, the only option available to him that we understand is for the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, which has clemency power in Georgia. It's not up to the governor in Georgia. It's up to this five-member panel. There is one option right now, and it's for this board to vote to stay his execution, to grant him clemency, and to commute his sentence to life or life without parole.
Troy Davis has already served 20 years on death row. Would it be possible that he could be released with time served?
Yeah, if they commute his sentence to life, there's a chance that he could be paroled out. You know, we'll just have to see what the board is willing to do, but our immediate concern is to make sure that that execution does not go forward.
I know that Troy Davis's sister, Martina Correa, has been working tirelessly for her brother's release. Do you work with her, or are you on parallel tracks?
Well, we've been working very closely with the Davis family for a long time. In fact, Martina and I both co-founded the Georgians for Alternatives to Death Penalty State Coalition back in 1999. She's a member of Amnesty International and has been a leader in the organization. And when she brought to our attention the case of her brother, we thought that there were some very salient issues that merited closer attention and a bigger effort that has really grown as more and more people have really connected with the story.
What can listeners do in the next week if they want to stop the execution of Troy Davis?
We would love for people to go to our website, justicefortroy.org. And if you go to justicefortroy.org, you'll find a number of actions that you can take. The most important one is to sign the petition calling on the board to grant clemency. But you can also follow us on Twitter. We have a Too Much Doubt campaign where we're tweeting doubts in the case on a daily basis. There's some celebrities that are involved with that, too. We have a bunch of events that are happening around the world and around the country. September 16th is our Global Day of Solidarity for Troy Davis. We have a major event in Atlanta, a march and prayer service. And there will be events in many cities around the world on the same day to show the global solidarity for Troy Davis and to send a message to the state of Georgia that it doesn't need to execute Troy Davis and it ought to stop the execution for the sake of human rights and to make sure that it doesn't commit what could be an unthinkable error by executing someone who may well be innocent.
That was Laura Moy, Death Penalty Abolition Campaign Director at Amnesty International USA. For more information on the campaign to stop Troy Davis's execution, visit our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.